You're listening to a Bookmark podcast. For rights reasons, we've had to shorten or omit some of the music chosen by our guests, but we hope you still enjoy listening.
You're listening to Bookmark on Cambridge 105.
Hello and welcome to Bookmark on Cambridge 105 with me, Lee Chambers. This is a show that talks about books and writing with a local slant. And we've got interviews today with Kate Swindlehurst, who's writer in residence at the Cambridge Botanic Garden, and with Ian Packham, round the world traveller. My studio guest, you couldn't get more local really, James Runcie, author of Grantchester. James, hello.
Hello.
I'm going to give you a proper introduction shortly, but I just wanted to talk to you about Grantchester, as we were talking about local things. Why you chose to set the books in Grantchester?
Well, I was born in Cambridge in 1959, and I've always been interested in rooting something in a real place. And the advantage with Grantchester is you get all the advantages of a village, a small community in the 1950s when this is set, with people who know each other. But you escape the Midsummer murders factor, because you have a whole town and a university nearby, meadows in between, river good for drowning, meadows good for murder, and then there's easy access to London. So it opens out a series of opportunities. You can go from the particular to the universal really easily. It also has such an iconic name, Grantchester. It sort of automatically sums up a kind of idea of Englishness, which a made-up place, if you called it Silbury or Silchester, which I thought about doing, because Trollope obviously makes up Barset and Barsetshire. I thought about it, but then I thought, no, let's really root it somewhere as real as possible and somewhere that says something. And of course, because the central characters are a clergyman and the old vicarage Grantchester is such a famous poem, it kind of everything seemed to fit. As soon as I had the idea, I thought, right, that's it.
Did it limit you, though? Because obviously people know Grantchester and people might say, well, no, that road doesn't go down there. You can't get to there so quickly.
Yes, well, we've had problems in the television series because we could only do a little bit of filming in King's Parade. So he'd bicycled up and down it various times. And at one time, he is going the wrong way to Grantchester. That is true on television. Obviously, I try not to make errors in the novel. It doesn't really limit you. You just have to be a little bit careful about who lives where and how different it was in the 1950s to how it is today. For example, a school and a garage and things like that. There's still a garage there, but you know it was much more populated by amenity, by shops and things like that. Whereas now it's a little both quieter and busier.
It gives you that chance to, as you say, have a small, remote community, but close to, when they go to London, that's the big city, that's very exciting, that's where all the jazz is.
Yes, it is, and of course there wasn't much jazz, well certainly there's no jazz club in Grantchester in 1953, I don't think there's one now, but It gives you a sort of flavour. It's very important. Often, if you're doing crime, it's often set in a small... You know, often you have country house murders or murders in one building or murders in a small community. So you narrow the number of suspects down. If you have a murder... I mean, obviously, you can set crime wherever you like, have it in London, in enormous big cities. But there's something about the concentrated focus of a small community that makes it easier and maybe more resonant to do crime that way.
Oh, well, we're going to be talking a lot about crime, but we're going to listen to your first piece of music now, which is, we're just talking about jazz, Sidney Bechet, Si tu vois ma mère. Why did you choose this?
Well, I chose this because I wanted a vicar, a central character, who wasn't a stereotype comedy vicar, like you might see in All Gas and Gaiters or Bless Me, Father of the Vicar of Dibley. I mean, I do like Rev very much, but I wanted something a little bit quirky, and I thought a love of jazz would give it a sort of certain swing. And that was the idea, to have a certain swing. And Sidney Bechet is one of the finest clarinetists and jazz saxophonists ever. And this track is If You Knew My Mother, Si Tu Vois Ma Mère, which is also in Woody Allen's film Midnight in Paris. And Philip Larkin has described Bechet's playing as like an enormous yes. And so I wanted something really positive and affirmative, and just to give it a bit of zing.
That That was Sidney Bechet, Si tu vois ma mère, the first choice of music by my guest, James Renzi. James is an award-winning director and writer. He's visiting professor at Bath Spa University, a fiction reviewer for The Independent, and author of, amongst others, The Grantchester Mysteries, recently adapted into the ITV series Grantchester, starring James Norton and Robson Green, which attracted almost 7 million viewers an episode. 7 million viewers, James. You must be very pleased with that.
Yeah, they wanted, they said, if I got 4, we'd be doing well. So we did. It's great, and it's just gone to America, and they're going to film a second series this summer. So if you see film crews out and about, that should be us. I mean, I'm not saying we're the only film crew who ever come to Cambridge and to Grantchester, but we're probably the only one who spends so much time in Grantchester.
How involved were you with the series?
I had what's laughably known as script approval. I say laughably because they seek your opinion and they say, yes, you have approval, but if you don't agree with them, they just say tough. Most of the time, they just say tough, we're doing it anyway. But I did, I mean, they did, for example, tell me about James Norton and said, look, we're thinking of this actor, what do you think? And I said, yes, please. I was involved in the casting and I was involved in a lot of the scripting, but I didn't write it, it was adapted because this is a 6-book series, and I'm just writing book 5 now, and it gets very confusing. It sounds very spoiled, doesn't it? But it gets very confusing if you're writing a book and then trying to adapt something you wrote 2 years ago. Being a man, of course, I can only do one thing at a time.
Well, I guess especially when it's crime and plot, you know, you get one plot mixed up with another.
Well, yes, and that's another issue, because Daisy Coulam, who writes it, does pull things together, and I'm slightly worried she's used up arson, for example, which is a big thing in the second series.
Too much arson already.
We can't do arson again. Yes, it does get confusing because you do have to think of and television does require much more murder and death, whereas the books have things like theft, but you generally do have to have a dead body before the first ad break.
And the casting, I suppose, that was crucial to you for Sidney Chambers in particular.
Sidney Chambers was absolutely crucial. I wanted a sexy vicar because I wanted somebody that would be appealing, and he's so great, James, and he does a lot of cheekbone acting. But he's a lovely man, and he read theology at Cambridge, and so he knows his stuff. And he has a very good... The only person that we did think was really obvious was Robson Green, playing a Geordie a police detective, because we really wanted Robson from the start. Obviously, we didn't tell him that, because he'd have wanted more money. But we did want Robson, and I'm very, very pleased with the chemistry between the two boys, as we call them. And then the women are fab, and then there was a crucial matter of casting the Labrador dog, Dickens.
Oh, yes, the most important thing.
The most important thing, because when in doubt, you know, there's quite a lot of things are thrown into this right at the beginning. The period cars, the steam train, the water, the sexy actor in a wet shirt. And then just in case it's still not working, you throw in a lovable, cute little Labrador puppy.
Sexy vicar and Labrador puppy. What more could you want?
What's the idea?
Why did you want him to be sexy?
I wanted him to be sexy because I was brought up as in a clergy family, and the clergy are often really patronised and thought of as rather sort of lovable fools, I found, in my childhood particularly. Sometimes, of course, they play up to this. but generally, I wanted them to somebody who would be serious, affectionate, appealing, attractive, and it had to be somebody, of course, who people would tell their secrets to. That's the issue. This has to be a man that people feel they can confide in, and that's one of the central ideas behind the whole thing, because Sidney Chambers can go... where the police can't.
Great name as well, if I may say so.
Yes, I know. Well, obviously, he's named after you, Lee.
Thank you very much. How did it come about? Did they approach you, or did
the
you send...
Thing.
Yes.
Well, the thing is, I've worked in television for a long time, and I did try to make it easy for them by writing a first book with 6 chapters in it that could easily turn into 6 one-hour television episodes. So I tried to make it very...
So you had an idea from the start?
From the start, I wanted it to be a television series. Yes, my brother-in-law, or rather woundingly, said to me, why don't you try and write something with popular appeal rather than all the other stuff you've been writing? So I thought, yes, and my wife had done Rumpole of the Bailey for on Radio 4, and a big friend of John Mortimer. She does all the Rumpoles on Radio 4. And so Chambers is a little nod to Dr. Rumpel's chambers. And a returning character was the idea, a character that you could grow and live with. And you would tell the story of post-war Britain, because the idea behind the books is that we'll go from 1953 to about 1978 and track social change, whereas the television series will stay in the 50s for as long as possible.
Yes,
because
very appealing,
they love
period,
that
yes.
appealing period. But that's the main difference.
And you must have been nervous about it, even so, the transition from book to screen.
Yes, and there's some period things that aren't entirely right. Some things, some of the lines aren't quite right. I'll take that as a no then. Christ on a bike, not a particularly 1950s phrase. But there's some things that we can't, you know, do much. I mean, there was there's a one sort of slightly radical thing that he preaches from the chancel rather than from the pulpit to make it more open. Some people have complained that the light coming through the window behind him is shining in the wrong direction because he's lit and that the church...
Those are very picky things, aren't they? Yes. I mean, you'd have to know your church stuff,
yes.
really.
I confess to one quite bad mistake, which has since been corrected. They have a joke about Agatha Christie, and they refer to the 450 from Paddington, one of her most famous books, and it wasn't actually published until 2 years later. Bit of a mistake.
I suppose it's the danger of setting things in the past, isn't it, that you do
yes.
have to, because it's within living memory as well,
yes.
so there will be people who say, no, they weren't that colour uniforms.
That's right, yes, yes. Army hats, the way you wear a Scots Guards wear their berets was another bit of an issue.
I guess you're hoping that the series, as well as just being enjoyable, will drive people to the books as well.
Yes, I do. Although it hasn't been that wildly successful at that, because I think people feel, well, I've seen it on telly, I don't need to read the books. But the idea is to push people towards back to the books and onto the books as well.
So far you've not seen... Seen that in sales?
Well, I haven't got the holiday home in the Bahamas yet, put it that way.
You will. I'm series two. Well, we're going to come back and talk more about Grantchester and crime, but we'll hear first from Kate Swindlehurst. Kate graduated from Anglia Ruskin University in 2009 with an MA in creative writing. A year later, she won an Arts Council Escalator Literature Award for her novel The Bridgehead. She's currently writer in residence at the Cambridge University Botanic Garden. I asked what inspires her as a writer.
A growing interest in memory, the process of memory, which was also integral to the Argentinian novel, but also to considerations of health and well-being, what maintains a good quality of life, I suppose. And part of that direction was fostered by a growing interest in nature writing generally. And it was that direction which was picked up when the Angles writing group that I was attending at the time was approached by the Botanic Gardens to ask for volunteers for the Voicing the Garden oral histories project. And I was very interested in that, in people's personal memories of the garden, the Botanic Garden, over the last 50 years or so. Interested in the training and recording oral histories. On the back of my response to say yes, I would be happy to volunteer, I suggested that they might like to consider a writer in residence, and that's how the residency kind of got off the ground.
So the residency came about through your suggestion?
Yes. There hasn't, as far as I know, been one in the past for any length of time, although the Thresholds programme that was curated by Karen Duffy last year, I think, was responsible for placing 10 poets in 10 different museums, including the Botanic Gardens. So Anne Gray was the poet in residence at the Botanics, and she spent a number of days over a period of months in the garden and produced a small body of new work.
And as a writer in residence, what do you do?
I turn up and write, basically. My initial approach was to enable me to kind of immerse myself in the garden. I hoped for a kind of an identifiable place to work, and I was offered shared desk space, but I ended up a lot of the time actually working in the cafe. I quite liked the public space and the, you know, the coming and going of garden users. My intention, the proposal, was to keep a record of my year as writer in residence, and in doing so to reappraise the idea of the journal, somewhere between a writer's journal and a gardener's journal, except I'm at most a very, very amateur gardener. What has grown out of the residency has been a themed short story collection with a story for every month, which builds very nicely on my background as a fiction writer. The story is linked by non-fiction pieces, so it's not a direct record of the year. But I'm pleased with the way it's materialising. It's still not finished, even though my year in the garden has sort of stretched to 18 months and still counting. And in addition to that, I've been producing a blog maybe once a fortnight, which is a more personal, less formal, less shaped response to what I've seen and heard and learnt and so on.
Have you found it's validated you as a writer to have this post, to have recognition, to have a bit of space? Money as well, is the post funded?
The post is funded. I was very fortunate to have funding from the Arts Council for a year, and also to enable me to find a writing mentor, which has been a great support.
So has this taken you in new directions?
It has. I think I had an expectation that basing myself in the garden would be essentially, it would take me further down the nature writing route. And it has done so. From a standing start, really, I did a week's course in flowering plant families quite early on, which made plain to me, really, the extent of my ignorance as much as anything. But what I hadn't anticipated was the kind of wealth of different inspirations and directions that the garden would present in terms of the people who work there, its history, the people who've shaped it in the past, plants that have come from the other side of the world, plant hunters, people who've pressed plants. You know, there's a whole myriad of directions. When I got about halfway through, I felt completely overwhelmed by all the different, you know, possibilities.
And what do you think it's given the botanics, having you there?
That's more difficult for me to assess, really. I've certainly been a presence. I have been visible as a writer, and that has generated interest amongst some of the staff and some of the friends of the Botanic Gardens in particular have been quite supportive. I think I had anticipated more opportunities in terms of making a kind of real and measurable impression in terms of workshopping and readings and so on. I've been able to do both of those, but on a very small scale, not as much as I'd hoped.
And has it changed you as a writer?
I think it's helped me to focus more on what I'm doing, but also to be open in a way that I haven't been able to be in the past. You know, I started with a blank page, if you like. Writing the novel, I planned and planned and planned and replanned, and this felt quite different. I felt like I was starting from scratch.
Has it been a learning experience?
It's been a huge learning experience. I think if I did the same thing again, I would start with a narrower focus. I think that would have enabled me perhaps to dig deeper in a way that has been difficult. I would have been less overwhelmed by the countless possibilities, I think, and more ready to focus on maybe an individual plant, so I think that would have been useful. And I think also I would want to be clearer in my own mind about how I envisage the relationship with the host, how that might work out in practice. And also, I've been disappointed by my faint-heartedness on occasion. You know, there's such an opportunity for learning, so many experts in so many fields, and I feel I haven't made full use of the expertise that's on tap somehow, partly out of a concern not to bother people who have very busy lives.
Do you think you've left something behind, a legacy, if somebody were to take this role after you, or to come in and find out what you've been doing?
I think one or two people certainly will remember that I've been there, and I'm hoping to be able to organise a public reading and perhaps an exhibition, and I'm hoping that, you know, people from the Botanics will be interested to come to that and think about what's been achieved.
That was Kate Swindlehurst there, writer in residence at the Cambridge University Botanic Gardens. My studio guest is James Renzi, author of the Grantchester Mysteries, amongst others. James, have you ever been writer in residence or ever been tempted?
No, I haven't actually. I've done a couple of teaching courses at the Arvon Foundation, but I've never been in residence. Sounds a rather good job, doesn't it? I mean, I think it might be.
It does if you get the right mix, I think, doesn't it? You don't want to be pushing a square peg into a round hole.
But I mean, if you worked in the botanics or somewhere like that, there's ample room for inspiration there, and actually, it's just an excuse to hang out and meet people and think, and it forces you to do things, I think. I think it would be great. I was rather amused. I knew Alain de Botton for a bit. I still know him, really, but I mean, I was a bit surprised. He was writer in residence at Heathrow Airport. Now, that's not something I wouldn't want to do. That's like being stuck, permanently delayed flights.
An obligation maybe to feel that you have to write about aeroplanes.
Yes, I wouldn't want to do that. But, maybe I could be writer in residence at Cambridge United.
Oh, yeah, well, it's a good time to be there. You've said that everything you're trying to do in fiction can be reduced to tell the truth, even if you have to lie to do so. What do you mean by that?
Well, I mean that if you have to basically it's about making things up. Lie is a rather dramatic little way of saying. Sometimes you have to, well, Philip Larkin said, tell it slightly at an angle. And you sometimes, in order to get a greater truth, you have to make things up rather than simply report on what's there. If you base something on a real crime, you've still got to make things up around it. And it's about the characters and the emotions of the crime. I'm much more interested in why done it than who done it, why things happen, what reduces people or pushes people to such violent acts, and what makes people desperate. And the great advantage of writing crime is that you are putting your characters on their mettle all the time. You're testing your character. You're testing the limits of their patience, their endurance, their forgiveness, their capacity to surprise. And you're always putting people in extreme situations. So that's the way, that's what crime does. That's the advantage of crime, rather than a literary novel about, you know, what I did on my holiday or something like that. I mean, you know what I mean. But crime, I think that's the great attraction of crime for so many writers. Not merely that crime seems to sell more than anything else, but you're given a plot, obviously, because you have to have a crime early on. If you're writing any novel, if you're trying to be Ian McEwan or Kazuo Ishiguro, you can start with anything, but with crime, you have to start with a crime. It has to be a crime.
But because you're looking at motivation then and emotions, does that mean for you as a writer you have to start further back than that? You have to say, you know, this character would kill because...
Yes, and also you start sometimes with a concept, with an idea. For example, I'm writing a story at the moment. It may not quite come out like this, but it's set in the Ely Cathedral, in the Lady Chapel of Ely Cathedral, where there are all these decapitated statues. So it would be interesting and dramatic, perhaps, to have a decapitated corpse in Ely Lady Chapel. How did it get there? Who did it? So sometimes you start with that kind of thing, and sometimes you start with thinking, I want to write about cricket, and so I'm going to set a murder at a cricket match, a village cricket match. So you're automatically doing something English, the village green cricket team, whites and everything. And then I went into I really tried to make it a poisoned cricket ball, but it's impossible to impregnate fully. So that, you know, when people sometimes lick their fingers before delivering a spin, if you could somehow manage, and I just couldn't quite get it to work, but it was really tempting, so that the poison was injected into the ball, so by licking the fingers before spinning the ball, the bowler was poisoning himself.
You must research all sorts of strange things. I mean, I remember Stephen King saying he lived above a vet or something, and he'd pop down every so often and say, ask the vet strange questions like, could a man consume a dog?
Yes, yes, no, absolutely. Yes, I had a very puzzled electrician when I was researching a story that's in the second book, which is an electrocution story, an electrocution in the bath. And I think he was about to report me to the police, because I kept saying, so how would you electrocute somebody? And how would you short that? And how would... So, yes, electrocution and... all sorts of things. You do, and if you meet people, taxiderm is another one I've got quite interested in. interested in, but I've got to be a bit careful about that. I do have a taxidermist, but Kate Moss has written a book called The Taxidermist's Daughter, and she's a friend of mine, so I don't want her thinking I've ripped her off. So I'm having to back off on the taxidermy now.
Is there a limited market for taxidermy stories?
I think there are a limited amount of taxidermy stories. But yes, but crime, you obviously, you know, the thing is, you really do want to watch the cliches, you know. It's very, very... You have to avoid... there are certain rules. You know, you have to avoid twin brothers and twin sisters and those kind of things. Lockroom mysteries are quite difficult to do these days. And you really... It's really... I think it's pretty bad if the doctor does it. I have done one with the doctor doing it, but I felt a bit bad about that because, you know, in Agatha Christie, that was one of my jokes. It's nearly always the doctor. You have to... Yeah, or the policeman. Or who's not a real policeman. But those kind of things. You just have to know what the rules are in order to break them. You have to know the genre and then have fun with it.
But by setting it in the 1950s, did that create more opportunities or less? Because you've not got mobile phones.
Yes, you've not got mobile phones. Well, there are quite a lot of advantages, I think, to the 1950s. First of all, the stakes are higher because the death penalty is still extant. So you've got to get... So there's still the death penalty. Homosexuality is illegal. So, and if you have a gay priest or that's the curate in the books, is gay, and limited opportunities for women. And it's pre-forensics. So what you have to do, what Sidney Chambers has to do, is go on what people say. And I'm very interested in subtext, in the difference between what people say and what they mean. And he has to get behind what people are saying and intuit the nuances of conversations. That gives you a lot of fun to play with. And I'm not very good at the eviscerated body and describing, you know, how a body's been left for 3 days and how it's gradually decayed. I'm not really that interested in that. And I don't do sex scenes, really, because I just think middle-aged male novelists doing sex scenes is just embarrassing. So we close the door on that kind of behaviour. And just enjoy two major things, morality, the morality of a scene, and motivation.
We'll come back to morality and motivation, but we've got your second piece of music now, which is one of Bach's French Suite. Why did you choose this piece?
Well, my mother... Everyone asked me about my dad, because he was a vicar and then he was Archbishop of Canterbury, but my mother has a massive influence on my life, and I wanted piano music to come through this novel that I'm writing, and so the novels that I'm writing, and Bach is the heart of everything I try to do, really, because it's what... The great achievement of Bach is there's no sign of strain or effort. It's quite very complicated music, but expressed extraordinarily lightly. And I think that's what the novelist has to do, to make the complicated seem effortless. And so there are two reasons for behind this. One is it's a tribute to my mother, who died 3 years ago, and it's a recognition of the anchoring of the rhythm of what I think all great writing and great music should be.
You're listening to Bookmark on Cambridge 105.
Yes, you're listening to Bookmark with me, Lee Chambers, and my studio guest is James Runcie. James, you're going to read something for us now.
Yes, but I thought I'd read the very beginning of the whole Grantchester Mysteries series, because it puts everything into context, and is a kind of way of obviously setting the scene. Well, I hope it is, because it isn't, I've utterly failed. So here it is. It's the opening story. It's called The Shadow of Death. And death, I mean also World War II. Canon Sidney Chambers had never intended to become a detective. Indeed, it came about quite by chance after a funeral when a handsome woman of indeterminate age voiced her suspicion that the recent death of a Cambridge solicitor was not suicide, as had been widely reported, but murder. It was a weekday morning in October 1953, and the pale rays of a low autumn sun were falling over the village of Grantchester. The mourners who had attended the funeral of Stephen Staunton shielded their eyes against the light as they made their way to the wake in the Red Lion. They were friends, colleagues and relatives from his childhood home in Northern Ireland, walking in silence. The first autumn leaves flickered as they fell from the elms. The day was too beautiful for a funeral. Sidney had changed into his suit and dog collar and was about to join his congregation when he noticed an elegant lady waiting in the shadows of the church porch. Her high heels made her unusually tall, and she wore a calf-length black dress, a fox fur stole, and a toque with a spotted veil. Sidney had noticed her during the service for the simple reason that she had been the most stylish person present. "I don't think we've met," he asked. The lady held out a gloved hand. "I'm Pamela Morton. Stephen Staunton worked with my husband." "It's been a sad time," Sidney responded. The lady was keen to get the formalities out of the way. "Is there somewhere we can talk?" Sidney had recently been to see the film Young Man with a Horn and noticed that Mrs. Morton's voice had all the sultriness of Lauren Bacall's. "Won't you be expected at the reception?" he asked. "What about your husband?" "I told him I wanted a cigarette." Sidney hesitated. "I have to look in myself, of course. It won't take long. Then we can go to the vicarage. I don't think people will miss me quite yet." Sidney was a tall, slender man in his early 30s. A lover of warm beer and hot jazz, a keen cricketer and an avid reader, he was known for his understated clerical elegance. His high forehead, aquiline nose and longish chin were softened by nut-brown eyes and a gentle smile, one that suggested he was always prepared to think the best of people. He had had the priestly good fortune to be born on a Sabbath day and was ordained soon after the war. After a brief curacy in Coventry and a short spell as domestic chaplain to the Bishop of Ely, he'd been appointed vicar to the Church of St Andrew and St Mary in 1952. "I suppose everyone asks you," Pamela Morton began as she cast an appraising eye over the shabby doorway, "if I'd prefer to live in the old vicarage, the subject of Rupert Brooke's poem. Yes, I'm afraid they do, but I'm quite content here. In fact, the place is rather too large for a bachelor." "You're not married." "Well, people have remarked that I'm married to my job. I'm not sure what a canon is. It's an honorary position given to me by a cathedral in Africa, but it's easier to think of me just as a common or garden priest." Sidney stamped his shoes on the mat and opened the unlocked door. "The word canon just sounds a bit better. Please do come in." He showed his guest into the small drawing room with its chintz sofas and antique engravings. Pamela Morton's dark eyes swept the room. "I'm sorry to detain you." "That's quite all right. I've noticed that no one knows what to say to a clergyman after a funeral." "They can't relax until you've gone," Pamela Morton replied. "They think they have to behave as if they're still in church." "Perhaps I remind them too much of death," Sidney inquired. "No, I don't think it's that, Canon Chambers. Rather, I think you remind them of their manifold sins and wickedness." Pamela Morton gave a half smile and tilted her head to one side so that a strand of raven hair fell across her left eye. Sidney recognised that he was in the presence of a dangerous woman in her mid-40s, and that this gesture alone could have a devastating effect upon a man. He couldn't imagine his interlocutor having many female friends. Mrs. Morton took off her gloves, her stole and her hat, laying them on the back of the sofa. When Sidney offered her a cup of tea, she gave a slight shudder. "I'm so sorry if this seems forward, but might you have something stronger?" "I have sherry, although I'm not that keen on it myself." "Whiskey?" This was Sidney's favourite tipple, a drink he tried to convince himself that he only kept for medicinal purposes. "How do you take it?" he asked. "As Stephen had it, a little water, no ice. He drank Irish, of course, but I imagine yours is Scotch." "It is indeed. I'm rather partial to a good single malt, but I'm afraid that I can't really afford it." "That is quite understandable in a vicar. You knew Mr. Morton well, I take it. Do you mind if I sit down?" Pamela asked, walking towards the armchair by the fire. "I think this is going to be a little awkward." Sidney poured out the Johnny Walker and allowed himself a small tumbler to keep his guest company. "It is clearly a delicate matter. We are not in church, Canon Chambers. Can I presume that the secrets of the confessional still apply? You can rely on my discretion." Pamela Morton considered whether to continue. "It's not something I ever imagined telling a priest. Even now, I'm not sure that I want to do so." "You can take your time. I may need to. I'm talking about murder."
Thank you, James. Oh, a dangerous woman in her mid-40s. We like those.
Yes, I've met plenty of them.
So that's the thing that gets the whole ball rolling. Yes. Why did you choose to set it at a funeral?
Well, funeral, of course, is one of the easiest things to set. If you have a clergyman as your central character, the funeral comes, that you introduce the idea of death immediately and you introduce a list of potential suspects. So it's the simple way of framing the church, his vicarage, the world, and the community at a time of crisis. And also, because it's officially a suicide, it brings in questions of forgiveness and self-destruction. So it's a way of getting several jobs done at the same time, I hope.
And you've talked in the past about wanting to address profound questions. I guess having a vicar as your hero allows you to do that.
Yes. Questions about loyalty, betrayal. I'm very interested in betrayal. And I'm interested in issues to do with, obviously, good and evil, birth and death, love and hope. And when... Because, actually, a lot of Christianity and a lot of faith is based on the concept of human failure. We can never really achieve all we want to achieve. We can never be as good as we want, and sometimes we can't be as happy as we want. And so what is it like? How do you live with the idea of falling short? That's one of the major things behind the books, really. How do we just try to leave as best lives we can without doing too much damage?
And the fact that a vicar asks himself these questions, yes, all the time, is he doing the right thing?
Yes.
I think gives the reader this sense of instability.
Yes, I think a vicar, well, it's in the nature of a vicar's job to keep asking that, because that is the job, it's in the job description for a vicar. I mean, I know it's in many people's job descriptions. We all feel, you know, we could do better. But In the priest, it's much more it's much more ill-defined. Here's a sort of rather stupid example, but it's one I use quite a lot. When you if you're a builder and you're building a wall or you're building a house, comes a time when the building is finished, when you think, I have finished that wall, I've finished that house, it's done. When you're a vicar, it's never done, so everything is unfinished. So how do you live with something that's an ongoing process?
And you talked about being a vicar and an archbishop's son, indeed,
yes,
your father being Robert Runcie. Was it therefore always inevitable that you would write something involving a character involved in the church?
Well, I think it was. I'd fought shy of it for a long time, and I started this when 10 years after my father had died. I think any sooner would have been difficult. And I didn't want people to think, and I needed to sort of achieve a few things so it didn't look like I was trading off it or trying to use my father's fame to be successful myself. I wanted to have written a few more books and made a few films and done stuff so that it didn't look like I was sort of jumping on the bandwagon or capitalising on that. But of course, if you've been brought up in a vicarage and you've seen death come to the door, and I wanted a character who was familiar with death, who was unsurprised by death, unshocked by it. And I wanted a vicar with a war record, like my father. I wanted him to have seen death. In the first story, people are patronising, thinking he was obviously a conscientious objector or a softy. And actually I wanted, you know, a vicar who had actually killed people, and just to be really blunt about it. And so that there was a sense of the cost of death and an awareness of that it can't just be some light thing. That's why I'm very, very hostile in a stupid, paranoid way to the phrase cosy crime, because this is called, I suppose, in the television series and it's billed as cosy crime rather than Scandi noir or Scottish noir, which is sort of rugged and brutal and violent. As if death in these novels is not violent. Of course it's violent. And I think that if you are going to call it cosy crime, you've got to be aware that underneath the cosy, the tea may be poisoned and the pot may be scalding. And you can't... There's no such thing as cosy crime. It's a ridiculous phrase. And I get sort of stupid about it, but I'm not going to go on about it now.
Well, you have more opportunity to go on about it later on in the show. We'll change gear slightly at the moment to talk to Ian Packham. Ian's a scientist, adventurer and writer. In 2013, he was runner-up in the National Geographic Traveller UK's writing competition. And he's author of Encircle Africa, Around Africa by Public Transport. I asked him what I thought was the most obvious question, why anyone would set themselves the challenge of journeying 25,000 miles through 31 nations using only public transport.
It may be the most obvious question, but there is no obvious answer to it. aside from the fact of just wanting to go out and do some travelling after being in education for so long, I just looked at Africa on a map and it seemed like this intriguing place, and I knew so little about it. I wanted to go and sort of investigate for myself and see if all this bad stuff we hear about it really on the news is the truth of what Africa is about.
And is it?
No, not at all. Africa is such a vibrant and positive place when you're there on the ground. Everyone is thankful that they're, you know, kind of alive that day and have money for that day and their kids are in school. And it's such a different perspective to what you see of this misery, which is basically all you see of Africa on the news.
I can understand why you might want to go to Africa, but why set yourself those rules that you can only go by public transport around that continent? Because, I mean, it's enormous.
It is. And one of the things about Africa is a lot of the big cities and historical places are situated on the coast. So this idea of following the coast all the way around started to develop. And really, the public transport bit of it came about simply because I don't really like driving. There's no way I could cycle that distance in the year I had. And so it just seemed like an obvious way of getting about.
So how did you define public transport? What rules did you set yourself?
So public transport is a bit different in Africa. There's no sort of integrated public transport systems, no numbers on buses and things like that. So it's really men who own a vehicle make their living driving a particular destination. So they act as a bus, and they tend to be called bush taxis, but it does depend where you are in the continent. And they just do that every day. And so it goes into my definition of public transport, but it's not public transport as we might imagine it.
It's very intrepid. Had you ever done anything like this before?
No, not really. I sort of came to travel a bit late in life. I'd been on holidays, but the furthest I've ever been was sort of Malaysia for 3 weeks. So to go on something like this for 13 months was a big change for me and a big challenge as well.
And you've written about it in the book. How did you find writing about the experience as opposed to living it? Obviously, it felt different, but how?
It's quite hard to describe putting your thoughts on paper. I had notes that I took every day through the trip. But going from reading the experiences and remembering these events that I'd experienced to having to look at it as a third person to write it down and to make a sensible narrative account that would entertain people and keep people reading on through was quite a difficult thing.
So you were making notes all the way through. So it was always your plan to write it as a book?
No, not at all. I've just done that when I've been on holiday. First holiday when I was five, we went to Denmark and we came back and my mum bought us some scrapbooks and we filled out day one, went to Legoland, that sort of thing. And every single time I've been abroad, I've kept a diary.
So you must have learnt a lot about writing by writing this book, as you say, about pacing it and keeping the reader's attention.
I learnt a huge amount. As somebody who had always enjoyed writing at school, and I'd written a few articles and things for magazines, but obviously a book is a totally different enterprise.
Now, be honest, were you tempted to make things up? Is there anything that's made up in there?
No, not at all. In fact, there are some amazing stories that aren't in the book because they didn't make sense in the narrative. I sort of thought to myself when I was writing it, and indeed doing it, because I was writing a blog as I went along, as soon as I stop telling the truth, then the whole enterprise becomes pointless, really. So even difficult things I was putting down on paper.
Hard to capture a continent like Africa on paper, really, isn't it? The sights and sounds and smells.
It's very difficult because Africa is about the sights and sounds and smells. It's not about going to museums and stuff like that. It's about being on the street, buying your meal off a Bunsen burner almost off the street, buying your fruit off a woman who's carrying it on her head. It's about those interactions rather than any massive sights.
And were you mentally writing it as you went along? Were you thinking, oh, this will be good?
The one good thing about going by public transport is it gives you a lot of time to think. So I'd be sitting on there for maybe 3 or 4 hours at a time and whole paragraphs would be forming in my head. And then when I got to a stop and I could write down, paragraph would just pour out of my head straight onto paper.
And are you a fan of travelogues generally?
I am. I read a lot of them and I've always been a fan of Michael Palin too. It's somebody I grew up with watching his programmes as he went around the world.
What makes a good travel book for you?
I think it is the interaction with the locals. It's all very well going around and showing the Taj Mahal or whatever. That's more a holiday programme, whereas a true sort of travelogue is about getting in there, interacting. By travelling by public transport, I had to interact. And it's just being as local as you can be while you're there, if I can put it in that respect.
And you weren't without incident, were you? I mean, you fought off thieves in Senegal, you were tear gassed in a museum, you were refused entry into the Democratic Republic of Congo, and mistaken for an undercover UN official during Liberia's presidential election. It's a lot to cram in and make sense of.
It's sad in a way that the things that sell the book are the sort of negative stories in a way, whereas I'm always trying to portray Africa as this positive place, and I have totally changed my perspective of the continent since being there.
What's your favourite country? You moved around. We're talking about Africa here as though it's one homogenous whole, and obviously it's made up of all these different countries with different personalities almost. What was your favourite country?
So there are 54 countries, I think, in Africa, and I went through 31 of them over 13 months, so I was moving pretty quickly. My favourite region certainly was West Africa, the bit I sort of feared the most. You know, the bits on the news now about Ebola, Sierra Leone, Liberia, Nigeria, those countries and the people in those countries just looked after me so well and wanted to give me this good impression of their country, which is such a surprise.
It's a shame that many of these people won't actually read the book.
It was, and it was, you know, I met these great people, and you're trying to, you know, give contact details, but they don't have email, they don't have phones that connect to the international system. So there are these people I met, and who were really kind to me, and I had real fun being with them, who I will never, you know, realistically speak to again.
Has it inspired you to write more?
Absolutely. What exactly, I'm not sure. I've always got ideas going around in my head. And as I say, I do write some articles, basically mainly travel articles for magazines and websites. I think I'd be disappointed if I didn't write another sort of book-length travelogue at some point in my future.
And what's been the reaction to this one?
It's been really positive, which is great for somebody with no sort of history in writing, to get strangers telling you how much they've enjoyed reading it or listening to me when I give talks about it, then that's such a real buzz, and I'm really pleased about that.
And did you discover, because often when people write, they discover actually hidden depths within themselves, or, you know, that they can be more poetic or more prosaic than they thought. Did you discover things about yourself just by writing it and reflecting on it?
I'm definitely a perfectionist, so I wanted every sentence to sound right, and that could be troubling when you know in the back of your mind you need to get this book out at some point, and you're sitting there for 2 days over this one sentence because it doesn't fit. Or, as I said, cutting out those stories that are brilliant stories but don't make sense to the narrative.
And I suppose reflecting that this is a book of your experience, it's one record of it, but actually your mental record is a different record as well, and the two can coexist.
And it'll be completely different. Every time I go back to the notebooks and every time I think about it, the ideas change. And, you know, if I were to think about it again in 10 or 20 years' time, it would be different again. And in fact, if I did the trip again, it would be completely different, because so much about the journey was those day-to-day interactions that were so spontaneous, they weren't planned, that it would be impossible to repeat them.
What would you think about other ways of recording it, perhaps with a voice recorder? I mean, it could make a brilliant radio series.
Yeah, and that's something I'm sort of looking into for my next trips. It's just having that sound or even the vision just adds that little extra something. But that's not to take away from books per se. I think books are an incredibly important part of our culture. And you can put so much across in writing, which maybe you can't. As soon as you put an image up, say, on the screen, then you've lost someone's imagination of what they're imagining you've written.
That was Ian Packham there. Interesting, Ian. We finished that interview, James Runcie, talking to Ian about the difference between radio and books. Do you find that people are automatically comparing your books to the TV show Grantchester, when actually, in a way, they're two different entities altogether?
Yes, people do. And obviously, the stories and the books are longer. You know, an ITV hour is about 46 minutes. And so there's much, much that's been left out and simplified. And so I'd like to think that you could do both. And I think that, obviously, what television and what radio can do this better, actually, is, but television is not so good at, is describing a thought process. So thinking time, consciousness, and with the vicar also, I'm afraid, you know, drag religion into this, prayer. So prayer, anxiety, worry, reflection is the basic thing, because obviously reflection is not essentially dramatic. It can be internally dramatic, of course, but on a screen it's very difficult to convey and give a sense of drama and purpose over that. So the literature always, in my opinion, literature will always give you more depth.
And I suppose that's why you rely on good casting. You rely on an actor who can convey an inner turmoil.
That's right, yes. And I think James Norton particularly can do that very, very well. But it's still difficult. You can't hang about, because it becomes rather self-indulgent if you have him just brooding. He has to get on his bicycle.
He does brood very well.
He does brooding. He does simmering. He does simmering brooding very well, very well. He does sexy brooding.
Now, you're committed to writing one of these books a year.
Yes, it's a bit terrifying.
Yes.
I mean, of course, you know, it sounds. I mean, it's one can't. How can one complain? It's ludicrous to complain about these kind of things. But the idea is that there are six. And volume four is published in May, and I'm just struggling away on volume five at the moment. So I've got another year to go, but I suddenly realised there might actually be eight. So I have to sort of keep going, because I've slowed it down, and I don't like to go so quickly through history, because the idea is to get to about 1978. And I think I know what happens, but there's a couple of major plot things I'm not ready to do yet. And I need to sort of spend more time on these kind of thoughts. So it's a great thing. I mean, I think writers should never complain about anything, because they're lucky to write. No one's asking us all to write books. The world's not desperate for them. So writers should realise that it's a complete privilege and luxury to have readers, and to be grateful to readers, and not to think they know better than readers, because readers always know better than writers.
So the books will go up to 1978, but the TV series will stay in the 1950s.
The TV series will stay in the 1950s until James Norton gets a bit older, I think. But also the TV series, there's definitely a second. We'll hope for a third, and then we'll see how we go.
But how will that work? Will they just move your stories that are set in the 60s and 70s into the 50s?
I think they're going to make some new ones. They're going to make some new ones. And I might end up coming back and doing the casebook of Sidney Chambers, a sort of 50s casebook. Once I've got to the end of the history, we might go back and have little casebooks. But at the moment, yes, and that is slightly alarming, because they do send me scripts and ideas that I kind of think, what? I didn't write any of this. Nothing to do with what I've written. So that's quite funny. But they are very, very good about telling me that. And a couple of things I've said, you absolutely can't do. Please don't do that. And they said, all right, we won't do that. But I said, what about this instead? So, you know, that's interesting. But yes, there will be divergence, which will be confusing for people who, slightly confusing for people who read and thing. But they are, as we started this little bit of conversation, they are very different things. They are different genres and different things.
And there's a sort of divergence anyway. You know, I've been reading and I found out who Sidney ends up with, you know, and,
yes.
And in the TV series, that's still on an edge. Yes,
certainly is.
I was quite disappointed in a way to find out.
Yes, yes. No, and that's, I think that'll be kept on edge for quite a while, I have to say, because there's quite a female fan base to this series, and so it's in our
interest. I wonder why.
So it's in our interest to keep Sidney as unmarried for as long as possible.
Oh, well, sadly, we've come to the end of the show, but thank you ever so much for coming in, James. It's been a pleasure to talk to you. Our next show, our studio guests will be young adult writer Harry Sidebottom. We'll also have interviews with invited writer at the Scott Polar Institute, Caddy Benyon, and illustrator Carolina Rabay. But we'll play out now with your last choice of music, James, which is Nina Simone, If You Knew. Why did you choose this one?
Well, I spent a lot of time away from my wife, who I've been with for 30 years, and I don't know why I spent a lot of time away, but I film and I travel and I write and I research. And she is a theatre director, so she's often away. So we're often apart, and it drives me absolutely mad. I hate being apart from her. And but then sometimes when she comes back, I think, can't you go away again, because I need to do some writing. So I have a very sort of conflicted thing, but sometimes I just want to tell her this.